Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're cutting straight to the heart of, well, some pretty significant political upheaval.
We are. Our source material is a really concentrated stack of political analyses.
And it's not just about who's up or down in the polls. We're looking at the actual levers of power, things like how information is being manipulated, where political loyalties are shifting, and how major institutions are being deliberately restructured as we speak.
That's absolutely right. Our mission today is to give you a shortcut to being well-informed. We're going to extract the critical nuggets of knowledge by organizing these, pretty complex stories around a few key themes.
So things like power manipulation, the fragmentation of political movements, and some really profound shifts in voter demographics.
Exactly. We're jumping straight into the thick of it.
Okay, so let's start with a story that really screams for institutional transparency. It's this recent development with the Jeffrey Epstein files. Congress just passed H.R. 405. It orders the Department of Justice, the DOJ, to release these files. Now, on the surface, that sounds great. A victory for accountability.
Right. But analysts immediately flagged the bill, saying it has giant holes.
Giant holes.
Yeah. And the speed with which this story moved from, total resistance to sudden compliance is, in itself, really fascinating.
So what's the core suspicion here? What are people worried about?
Well, the theory that's being discussed by insider sources has a name. They're calling it the Great Scrubbing.
The Great Scrubbing.
Yes. The idea is that it's a calculated effort to control the political fallout, that the files will be meticulously purged of any mention of Republican figures or major donors.
And just leave the dirt on Democrats.
Exactly. Ensuring only damaging information on Democrats, their donors, various hangers-on, ever sees the light of day.
And this isn't just a random conspiracy theory, right? There's some backstory.
No, not at all. You have to go back to July. Senator Dick Durbin alleged that the former Attorney General Pam Bondi assigned something like 1,000 FBI agents to review 100,000 documents.
1,000 agents? For what?
Specifically to flag any material that mentioned Trump for destruction.
Wow. And how credible was that source?
It gained immediate credibility because Durbin's source mentioned a very specific kind of weird detail. A crude or bawdy birthday card Trump had sent to Epstein.
And that turned out to be true.
It was later confirmed. And now you have Mark Epstein, Jeffrey's brother, pouring fuel on this fire.
Right. He's been very public.
Very. He's on record saying his brother definitely had dirt on Trump, that everything Trump says is a lie. And this is key, that he's heard directly that these files are being actively sabotaged in advance.
So if this first release is compromised, is that it? Is the whole investigation dead in the water?
Well, that's the big question of future political leverage, isn't it? I mean, if Democrats manage to get subpoena power back in Congress after, say, the 2026 midterms,
then the door swings wide open again.
It does. They could go after the 4,700 suspicious transactions JPMorgan Chase flagged. They could subpoena the lawyers for Epstein's estate.
You could even potentially offer Ghislaine Maxwell a deal.
A deal for testimony, yes. And let's not forget, the FBI confiscated hundreds of physical DVDs. Plus, there are victims who are still willing to name names directly to the House Oversight Committee. It all just errands. It hinges on who holds power.
That's a great point. And actually, the whole Epstein controversy is one of the factors that analysts are pointing to as a cause for fractures in the MAGA coalition.
It's one of several, for sure.
The analysis we're looking at notes that as the former president's approval rating declines and this kind of lame duckishness sets in, other Republicans are starting to realize that, maybe they won't be punished forever for disagreeing.
The internal cracks are becoming chasms. And what's so fascinating is that these fissures aren't just ideological. They span like six key areas. Mm. It shows how broad the discontent is getting.
Okay, so where do we start?
Well, you just mentioned Epstein. In a recent poll, only 45% of Republicans approve of Trump's conduct around that whole issue. That's a huge internal weakness right there.
Only 45%? Wow.
Then you had these deep, sort of sophisticated ideological differences playing out. Our sources contrast someone like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who the analysis calls a wacko.
A firebrand, right.
With the profile of someone like Thomas Massie.
Who is a completely different animal.
A whole different animal.
Yeah.
He's an MIT-educated engineer, a tech founder with 24 patents, a deeply committed libertarian.
But they're both described as pit bulls.
Yes, because they both refuse to concede ground. But one is driven by grassroots populism and the other by these, deeply held philosophical principles. Their divergence really shows the Magian coalition isn't one idea. It's a temporary alliance.
And we saw a very public blow up recently over the anti-Semitism divide.
A massive one. You had Tucker Carlson and Candace Owens defending the anti-Semite Nick Fuentes, and the Heritage Foundation actually backed them on it.
Which is what prompted Ted Cruz to step in.
Right, and that was a huge rupture for Senator Ted Cruz to come out and call this a cancer in the party. I mean, when he has to be the moral center, it just shows you how far into the fringes some elements have gone.
Then you have straight-up economic conflict.
The tariff paradox. The base loves tariffs in theory. It's America first. But they're furious about the high cost of living that those very tariffs help create.
You can't have it both ways.
You can't. And you see the same split with H-1B visas. Big business desperately needs skilled foreign labor. But the anti-immigrant base wants to cut the program. Even Trump disagreed with Laura Ingraham on that one. It shows the tension.
And finally, there's the GWIFT.
Yes. The growing realization that opposing the personal corruption could actually be a winning strategy for someone in 2028.
The analysis points to things like the $350 million collected for a gilded palace, the Jared Kushner Fund.
The $2 billion from MBS, yeah. Republicans are realizing that voters who are maybe struggling, who lost their SNAP benefits, are starting to ask why so much wealth is being consolidated personally. Opposing that is becoming a real platform.
So Bill Kristol's observation really makes sense here, that encouraging these fractures might be more effective for the opposition than waiting for a moderates to
find their spines, yeah. It shifts the strategy from hoping for conversion to actively encouraging an explosion.
Let's move our focus from party dynamics to institutional restructuring. Mm. We need to look at the current administration's efforts to dismantle the Department of Education.
Right.
He can't just abolish it by executive order, so what's the method being used?
It's an administrative end run. He's essentially gutting the agency by moving its money and its programs somewhere else.
For example,
$28 billion for K-12 schools is being shuffled over to the Department of Labor. Indian education programs are now going to the Department of the Interior. It just drains the DOED of its purpose without formally killing it.
And it's so important to clarify what the Department of Education actually does, because it is widely misunderstood.
So misunderstood. It does not set curriculum. It doesn't hire teachers. That's all local.
Its main function is financial.
Purely financial. It's about leveling the playing field. School funding is based on local property taxes, right? So you get this massive disparity. Compare Scarsdale, New York, where the median income is $238,000.
To somewhere like Perry County, Alabama, where it's just $36,000.
Exactly. Without the DOED funneling federal money to those poorer districts, the quality of your education is just totally dependent on where you were born. The inequality gap widens dramatically.
And there's a philosophical conflict here, too.
A huge one. The education secretary, Linda McMahon, sees education solely as a way to prepare kids for the workforce.
Versus the idea that its function is to create an informed citizenry for a democracy.
Right. And that disagreement is why critics, like Senator Patty Murray, called these efforts outright illegal. She's warning that if you move these complex education programs to, you know, the Department of Labor,
which has no expertise in teaching.
None. No expertise in pedagogy or specialized student needs.
Yeah.
You'll just see a collapse of necessary services.
Okay, on that same topic of institutional integrity, we have a major update on Dominion voting systems.
A very quiet one, but yes.
After that massive $787 million settlement from Fox News, the company has been sold.
It was acquired by a company called Liberty Vote, which is owned by a man named Scott Leindecker.
And he is a former Republican election official from Missouri?
He is. And what's immediately raising alarms is the total lack of transparency. The deal was privately financed. The price was undisclosed. No IPO.
And his plans for the company are also pretty significant.
Absolutely. He has openly embraced these election integrity concepts that are favored by Trump, like paper ballots. And he said Liberty Vote would comply with the former president's executive order on voting.
Including the part that was blocked by a judge.
Yes, the part requiring proof of citizenship to vote a federal judge already called unconstitutional, because the president can't just tell states how to run their own elections.
This has to be generating some serious distrust.
Oh, immediate distrust. You have Rep. Jasmine Crockett calling for states to just drop the machines entirely. Local election clerks are furious about the lack of transparency around who now owns the machines that, you know, a third of all Americans use to vote.
It seems like if the goal is just a clean sale, you do an IPO.
Of course. That's the transparent path. It would require auditing, selling it secretly to a former partisan official who plans to embrace legally questionable maneuvers.
Yeah.
It raises serious questions about the real motivation here.
All right, let's shift gears now to campaign dynamics and the electoral forecast, starting with some polling.
Okay.
The new Marist poll on the generic House ballot shows a pretty significant lead for Democrats. D plus 14. That's a jump from plus 7 just a little while ago.
That is a staggering margin. Now, of course, one poll is just a snapshot. Politics is volatile.
Of course. But if a margin like that were to hold,
it would signal a massive blue wave. It would put 131 Republican seats, basically any district that's R plus 13 or less, into play. That kind of margin suggests deep systemic discontent.
But the real revelations are in the CNN analysis that looks at demographic shifts across the last few cycles. What's the big takeaway?
Well, first, there are some pretty significant minority shifts. Latino men are described as a disaster for Democrats. Kamala Harris underperformed Joe Biden by 33 points with them.
And Hillary Clinton by 41 points. That's huge.
It's an astonishing number. Conversely, the analysis calls black women hugely faithful to the Democratic Party. That remains a very solid block.
And the education divide is still there.
Still there and still very stubborn. White non-college voters are a solidly committed group for Trump, no matter who he runs against. It's a persistent structural problem for Democrats. They just haven't found a way to speak effectively to that group.
But the single biggest aha moment, the one data point that really shifts the tectonic plates, is the movement among first-time voters.
This is truly astonishing, and it speaks directly to the power of personalized appeal. We saw a 43-point shift.
A 43-point shift. Let's break that down.
In 2020, Biden won first-time voters by 32 points. In 2024, Trump won them by 11 points.
That swing is unbelievable. It means he's reaching low propensity, first-time voters in a way that other Republicans just can't.
It's proof that his appeal is highly individualized. It's not a shift to Republicanism as a party. It's a personal affection for him, which creates a ton of energy on Election Day, but is, analysts suggest, completely non-transferable.
And just quickly, a note on the California governor's race. Xavier Becerra's campaign is in crisis.
Yes. Two of his top aides were indicted for stealing $225,000 from his campaign. Now, he wasn't implicated in the fraud.
But the critical issue is that he didn't notice it.
Exactly. His entire pitch for governor is that he's a great manager.
Yeah.
It's a job overseeing 250,000 employees. If you can't notice that much money disappearing from your own campaign,
it completely undercuts the very basis of your candidacy.
Severely.
So to wrap this up, let's summarize what we've learned. We navigated the deliberate manipulation of information with the suspected great scrubbing of the Epstein files.
We identified the deep structural fragmentation of the MAN-GA base across six major fault lines.
We looked at the decay of institutional power with the quiet dismantling of the Department of Education. And we observed these dramatic, massive shifts in voter allegiance.
Especially among Latino men, and that shocking 43-point swing with first-time voters.
Right.
I mean, these stories really show that political power is being defined by two forces right now, consolidation and decay.
Yeah.
Power is consolidating in secret, like with the Dominion sale, while institutions are decaying from the inside, like the DOE-ed.
And the coalitions supporting these structures are just fracturing.
From internal dissent and economic pressure, exactly.
We ended on that extraordinary data point, the 43-point swing among first-time voters. It shows the strong, unique personal affection for Donald Trump that just does not translate to other Republicans.
It really doesn't.
So here's the thought to leave you with. If the core of electoral success relies more and more on a singular, highly personalized appeal, one that's divorced from the traditional party infrastructure, what are the long-term, non-transferable risks that structure poses to a party that wants to maintain power after that individual eventually leaves the stage? That's a fundamental question to consider as the 2028 campaigns really start to heat up.